Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, first do no harm, that phrase which is usually attributed to Hippocrates himself. And while it's not actually part of the famous Hippocratic Oath, it's a principle that most of us assume that any doctor is going to be guided by anyway. Doesn't matter whether it's a surgeon, a specialist, or just your local GP. When you're looking for medical help, you're placing a huge amount of trust in the doctors providing your care, as well as the institutions they're working in. You are, literally, putting your health and life in their latex-gloved hands. So you need to trust that whatever test, drug, or treatment they recommend is actually going to help you. At the very least, you assume that's not going to make you worse. Well, we'll be joined tonight by two people who argue that this simple assumption just isn't the case, that in our modern medical system, over-treatment and over-diagnosis is rife. The benefits of treatments are often wildly overstated, and perhaps most concerning, the potential harms of treatments are frequently minimised or swept to the side. Astoundingly, it's been estimated, say the authors, that about one-third of medical care, one-third of medical care is of no value, while another 10% is actually harmful. Despite widespread evidence of this, much of which is discussed in their book, many doctors continue to perform procedures and prescribe treatments known to be ineffective. Why is this happening? Now, this is not just the view of fringe-dwelling medical outsiders. Professor Rochelle Buchbinder is a rheumatologist and epidemiologist and the director of the Monash Department of Clinical Epidemiology since its inception back in 2001, widely published in scientific circles. Or so is Professor Ian Harris, an orthopaedic surgeon at Liverpool, St George and Sutherland Hospitals in Sydney, as well as being a professor of orthopaedic surgery at the University of New South Wales. Both of them internationally recognised in the field of evidence-based medicine. And they are the authors of the book Hypocrisy, How Doctors Are Betraying Their Oath. Let's talk to them. Rochelle, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for having us.
Ian, terrific to have you with us as well. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks.
Yes, how doctors are betraying their oath. It could be seen as a controversial statement at a point in time when we're all being asked to put a lot of faith in the health advice of medical professionals right now. Should anything either of you say tonight be seen as support by some of the anti-medicine sentiment we're seeing at the moment?
I think that's a good point that you raise, because often when we talk and we say, oh, medicine is not living up to its promise and there's problems with it, people think that we're anti-medicine and therefore pro, you know, alternative medicine or whatever. And that's not the case at all. All we're doing is saying that medicine needs to be a proper science. And a lot of it's good and a lot of it is proper science. But a lot of it is pseudoscience or doesn't have good evidence. And that's bad. And that's the same thing for you know, anti-medicine things. They're often very anti-scientific. So, you know, we need to make that clear that we're not anti-medicine and pro junk science. That's for sure. We're the opposite of that.
No, Rochelle, one of the points in your book, in this sense, is that more medical care is not necessarily better health.
Yes, so we argue that. you know, medicine is a system that promotes doing things and doing health care, but a lot of what we do doesn't actually improve health, and we cite problems of over medicalization, so medicalizing common everyday things that happen in life, turning it into a medical condition. We overdiagnose, we do too many tests, and we overtreat. And arguably, as you said in your introduction, 30% of that is of no value, and another 10% is possibly actually doing people harm.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I guess I was just going to say that I concur with Ian, and we really did not set out to erode trust in doctors. What we want to do is really promote more scepticism and getting patients and doctors to question what what is done, really.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we'll get to that at the end of our conversation tonight, which is the critical point, I think, of your book, and that is that let's just have a bit more critical thinking and a bit more critical survey of what we're being told and what we're being offered in medicine. Indeed, doctors need to be doing that as well. And you do suggest some steps that can be taken. Both of you have had experiences that helped unblinky you to some of the failings of modern medicine. Rochelle, what was it for you?
So I guess it was, lots of different things, but seeing, learning from people that train you and then asking questions and realizing that, you know, simple things that were commonly taught. When I started doing clinical epidemiology, I had to go back and find the evidence for that. And one of my first experiences was for a disease called systemic lupus erythematosus. And at that time, everyone was treated with a drug called Plaquenil, which has been in the news, especially last year, as a, you know, as a treatment for COVID that didn't work. But at that time, I looked back to try and find out what where did it start? How did we prove that Plaquenil was the right drug for this disease? And it turned out it was in a book written by a very famous rheumatologist, and it was based on his experience of about 6 or 7 patients. So there were no studies, there was no evidence that it worked. It was just based on this prominent person's opinion. And yet it was something that we all did. In fact, about, it must have been 20 years later, someone did do a trial. So you couldn't actually do a trial of this treatment because people were too scared. It was the common, that was the treatment that was thought to prevent flare-ups of the disease. So people in Canada actually did a trial where they withdrew it. So people were well controlled on the Plaquenil, and half the people were withdrawn the drug and the other half continued it, and no one knew which group they're in. And in fact, they did prove that being on Plaquenil was better for you. But it didn't start out that way. And that really led me on a process of discovery, looking to see how many things that we were taught was actually based on good science, and increasingly finding that a lot of the things that we do, when you actually test them in placebo-controlled trials, didn't do any better than the placebo, and sometimes they had harms that actually made it even worse.
Exactly. You had a similar experience with a shockwave therapy machine, which was used to break up kidney stones, didn't you?
Yeah, so that was a study that we did to see whether this treatment worked for heel pain,
because that's what it was widely being promoted as, wasn't it? It did break up kidney stones, but it was being widely promoted as, oh well, this is a magic treatment for tennis elbow or heel pain.
Exactly, and it was, you know, again, it was pseudoscience. It was supposed to, the sound waves are meant to break up adhesions, and that was meant to stimulate healing, and so it sounded really, really good in a pseudoscientific way, but when we actually tested it, it was no better than placebo, and it just happened to be published in the US in the week that it was approved by the FDA. So lots of people were not very happy with the findings of the study, to put it mildly.
Well, to put it mildly, I mean, you copped a lot of abuse, didn't you?
I didn't even know that was just the start of the abuse that I was going to cop. And it was pretty mild at that time, really, thinking back on what subsequently happened. But, yeah, I'd wake up and I'd have this very nasty email, and, yeah, it went on for quite a while.
Ian, you've had a similar experience that highlighted the lack of evidence for some new treatments. There was a procedure being used by a colleague to treat back pain, which was pretty much what a medical device inserted in the back that allegedly shrunk the impacted disc.
Yeah, that's right. And it sounds like something that might work. And I mean, my whole career has been looking at things that have been put into practice because they sound like a good idea and they sound logical. But the link between something that sounds like a good idea and finding out that it actually works is massive, I've since found out. It's not a small jump, it's a large jump. And this is a device that was developed by some doctors in the US, brothers. And you just put this probe through the skin, through your body, into the disc in between the vertebrae, and it heats up. And it sort of congeals, you know, like frying an egg. It congeals the disc and shrinks it up. I mean, that sounds fantastic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And so they developed this machine and they did lots of studies where they did this on people and the people said they felt better afterwards. So they didn't do controlled trials where they did it on some people and didn't do it on others. They just did it and people said they felt better at some stage afterwards, which normally happens with back pain anyway. And then they published what's called a systematic review, where they took all of their low-quality evidence, piled it all together, and then published it as a high-quality review. And not surprisingly, they ended up selling the rights to the machine for hundreds of millions of dollars, made an absolute fortune. But it wasn't until sometime later that people started doing proper scientific studies to find out whether it works or not. And in simplistic terms, this is where you compare doing something to not doing something. And that sounds really basic, but those tests are rarely done. Normally, it's enough that it's a good idea. And yeah, they found that the group, and so people were blinded. So everybody had the probe put in, but only half of the patients had it turned on. And the group, the patients didn't know whether it was turned on or not. And of course, the percentage improvement in both groups was exactly the same, which meant that this was doing absolutely nothing.
This is one of the disturbing things when you read your book. That is that, in fact, you make a comment. You say if orthopedic surgery was a drug, it would never get approved.
That's right.
I mean, for coming from an orthopod themselves, this is not exactly reassuring. But one of the points you make is that treatments get approved as long as they are safe, but there's not a lot of incentive to do trials to see whether they actually do any good or not. And in orthopedics, this is a commonplace problem. It seems that you know, things are done to you, which, well, they aren't going to kill you, but they don't actually work.
I don't want to single out orthopedics, but surgery in general isn't held to the same standard as a new drug. Even there's still problems, though, with introducing new drugs. You know, it's the what do you use as the marker of success? So in cancer drugs, for instance, instead of finding out whether you live longer with the drug instead of not having the drug, they use lots of substitute surrogate outcomes like, did the tumor shrink a little bit more in a specimen or something? And if you say the tumor shrunk more, then the drug gets on the market. But then later on, you find out that people don't live any longer and they get complications from the drug. So it's not actually helping anybody. But the standard for surgery is not even that. You don't have to do a study showing that surgery is better than not doing surgery. If you think it's a good idea and it sounds good, you start doing it and then you go and tell everybody about it. And then you publish what's called a case series where you say, I did it 100 times and 80 of the patients felt better afterwards.
Look, I don't want to single out orthopedics either, but one of the really disturbing things you say is that procedures are often performed even when doctors know they don't do any good. Knee arthroscopies are a classic here, that they're still being performed routinely. In fact, they're being performed in increasing numbers in some parts of the world, even though doctors know from well-controlled studies that in most cases these operations don't do any good at all or make things worse.
Yeah, I'd probably challenge you there. I don't think the doctors that are doing the operations that don't work know that it doesn't work.
How can they not?
Because they don't believe the evidence.
Right.
And that's a very human sort of trait, is that if you do something to people and a lot of them feel better afterwards, you tend to assume cause and effect. You tend to attribute the improvement that you see to the procedure you did. That's a very natural response that humans have. If they see one thing come after another thing, they think the first thing caused the second thing.
Mm.
It's a short evolutionary shortcut.
Mm.
And when you say, oh, but they did a study in Finland where they pretended to do it on half of the patients and actually did it on half the patients and it made no difference at all, then surgeons say, well, who are these guys? They probably do things differently in Finland. They're probably hopeless. They're not as good as me.
My operations are not like that.
The other thing is, oh, yes, I agree with the study. There's so many doctors out there doing it, you know, for all the wrong reasons, but I can pick the patients that get better.
Yeah, they're not my operation.
And I only operate on the ones that I know will get better because I can pick them. And my answer to that is, well, then you need to do a study on those patients that you think will get better and prove it.
Mm. We can talk about placebos again in this conversation, Rochelle, but it's the whole topic of placebos is fascinating, isn't it? There was a study you cite in the book of, I think it was for back pain, where the patients in the trial were told, who suffered from back pain, were told that the pill they were taking was a placebo. They were told that this is a placebo. Understand that. This is a sugar pill. It's a placebo. It has no medicine in it. And people saw that and, you know, down the hatch it went. And many of these patients reported an improvement. And afterwards, some even inquired where they could get these pills from. So
exactly.
The point you're making in your book, both of you are making, is that reported improvements doesn't necessarily mean that what you did anything to cause the improvement.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these conditions that we've talked about so far are what we call self-limiting. So they get better over time,
whatever you do.
Hmm. Yeah. So intervening, we always laugh with back pain, you better see the patient really quickly before they have a chance to get better and sell them whatever treatment you want to give them because, you know, we know they're going to get, most people get better within 6 weeks. So, treating people early for something that we know gets better quickly just doesn't make any sense. Mm. And it's much better to give that advice and information to patients rather than selling them stuff because you feel like you have to do something active.
Mm. Look, in your book you talk about the problems that of all this under a number of headings, including medicalization, over-diagnosis, over-treatment, and the practice of medicine as a business. Let's get through some of these. Let's talk about medicalization. Rochelle, the medicalization of aging, you say, is a massive problem. We've come to consider getting old a disease, and a disease that needs to be treated. And in particular, you mentioned sarcopenia. Tell us about this.
So sarcopenia is a word that means weak muscles. So if you lie in bed for more than 24 hours, your muscles will be weaker than when you went to bed. So and as you get older, we age. Our body ages. It gets wrinkles in the muscles and as well as on our faces. So it can just be seen as a normal part of aging. And we know that we're living longer, so we see more of it. And what happens, though, is that it gets sort of hijacked and becomes a disease in its own right. And, in fact, sarcopenia is now a disease. It's now listed in something called the International Classification of Diseases as a disease. So it's got criteria that make it's a disease, and they're recommended remedies, and they range from, you know, balance and strengthening exercises, which I agree with, but you don't need to have a label of sarcopenia to do that.
No.
But it may also then, if the muscle weakness doesn't get better, then that's a huge market to try new drugs on, drugs that, you know, increase muscle strength, you know, the ones that the sports people use, for example. In some instances, it might be a way of selling drugs that people make because they develop a market for it that didn't exist before. And it's not just sarcopenia, it's, you know, the condition of thin bones, which also thin as you get older, so something called osteopenia or pre-fracture. So you can treat them before it happens. You can treat pre-hypertension these days. So there's a whole lot of conditions that have been just part of normal aging and That's suddenly right. have labels.
It's called getting old. And all of a sudden exactly. it's got a label, and therefore it's susceptible to treatment and drugs and all the rest of it. We're talking with Professor Rochelle Bookbinder, a rheumatologist and epidemiologist from Monash, and Professor Ian Harris, orthopaedic surgeon at Liverpool, St George and Sutherland Hospitals, and professor of orthopaedic surgery at the University of New South Wales. We're talking about their book, Hypocrisy, and the problems of the, excessive amounts of medical care, which do no good. We've talked about the medicalisation of ageing. We've talked a bit about back pain. Ian, tell me about the impact that medicalisation has in the area of mental health.
Yeah, that's another thing where we've been very quick to medicalise what can be a normal predicament of life. Mm. So, you could probably take depression as a good example, because clearly there's a spectrum, you know, from people who are feeling a bit down or feeling maybe reacting to loss, to the other end of the spectrum where there's clearly something, you know, pathological, where these people can't function. They have what's called major depression, and there's lots of drugs for depression. And interestingly, when they first developed the most common drugs that were prescribed for depression, which are the SSRIs, when they first developed them, they didn't think there'd be a market for them, because they thought, well, you know, who's going to take these? There's not that many people around with depression. But they created a market for them because they got given to anybody who just felt out of sorts or a bit down or a bit depressed. Mm. But the problem is they are probably effective for major depression. And it's like a lot of other things where we've expanded the definitions of things. Drugs can be effective for the most severe cases, but for most people with moderate depression, these drugs don't work any more than pretending to give the drug.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We've had a long discussion, in another controversial area, the area of opioids, with this discussion as well, because, you know, it's quite clear that beyond a certain point and for certain reasons, very short periods, opioids don't work. And yet people continue to prescribe them, doctors continue to prescribe them, and people continue to take them because they say, yes, they do. But we know from the scientific evidence that that's just not true, don't we? Rochelle?
There's evidence that things like back pain, that opioids actually delays recovery. And there's plenty of evidence in workers' compensation that if you're on opioids, you usually are off work for much, much longer than if you never started opioids or you only had them for a very brief time. Mm. And you're right, the evidence is that they don't work that well.
Yeah,
and they have lots of potential for harm, and I'm sure you've covered that before.
It was a rather spiky conversation because a lot of people, you know, rang and said, you know, this is a scandal because it means I can't get my pills, I can't get my tablets anymore. One of the other points you make is that the criteria for what constitutes a condition usually seems to broaden rather than contract. In other words, things that were seen as problems suddenly become much bigger problems because we have lowered the threshold at which they become a problem. Now, this has happened for hypertension or high blood pressure as well as gestational diabetes. Ian?
Yeah, well, in blood pressure, they've got a new classification called pre-hypertension. So they're trying to expand it so that, you know, drugs can be used more widely. But again, the problem is these drugs are very good for people with very high blood pressure, but they probably don't benefit people who are marginally high blood pressure, and yet they still have the same side effects. So they're less effective, but just as harmful. But the criteria that they're proposing would mean that most people aged 45 to 75 would have abnormal blood pressure. And I think when you change the classification of something so that most people have it, you've really got to, it really questions what's normal and what isn't.
And I guess if I just butt in that it's important to note that doctors are doing this with the right intentions. They think they're saving people, and they probably start out thinking that pre-hypertension, this is a warning to the patient that they're heading in the wrong direction, and perhaps they need to stop smoking, lose weight, the lifestyle things. But somehow or other, that evolves into taking medication. And often when people widen disease definitions, they think about the potential for benefit, but they don't really think about the potential for harm, and that potential is enormous for treating people unnecessarily.
Yeah. Let's talk about one of the things that you think, this must obviously be an obvious good, is screening programs. Let's screen people for cancer, particularly cancer screening programs like Breast Screen and others, and there are plenty of other screening programs for all sorts of things, including prostate cancer. The trouble with screening programs is that they tend to may be of limited use and also make problems out of things that weren't problems. Ian?
Yes, exactly. There's lots of problems with screening. They will tend to miss aggressive tumours, because aggressive tumours come very quickly, and you'll get it in between your screening appointments of every 2 years or whatever. They tend to pick up things that would not normally hurt you. For every one case that you might pick up, there's massive numbers that are overdiagnosed. And I think the best example we give in the book is what happened in South Korea when they went on a program of cancer screening. And one of the cancers that they screened for was thyroid cancer. Now, it turns out that if you do a scan or an ultrasound of a group of people's thyroids, you will find cancers, these low-grade actual cancers that about a third of people have, but they would never know, and it would never hurt them.
Right.
And so what happened is that in about 15 years, the rate of thyroid cancer in Korea increased 15-fold, and it came to the point where tens of thousands were being diagnosed every year, and it became the most common cancer in the country, which is ridiculous because thyroid is nowhere near the most common cancer anywhere else. But it's because they were screening everybody. Now, it's very hard to explain to people how screening is bad, because most people look at it and they go, I don't know.
It seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? I mean, yeah, how could it not be a good? Because, one of the common things is, if only they'd picked it up earlier, he or she would have been all right, So,
if you screen me, surely we'll know more than we did before you screen me, and surely more knowledge is good. But what happened in Korea, and the reason why it's such a good example, is that the 40,000 people a year that were being diagnosed, most of them were in young people, disproportionately in women, and they were being treated with thyroidectomy. So they were having their thyroid gland removed. Now, that's a very serious operation. That means you're on lifetime replacement of thyroid hormone. In 2% of them, they lost their voice because they took out the nerve that goes to the vocal cords. And in over 10%, they also lost, because it's a complication of thyroidectomy, is to accidentally take out the parathyroid hormones, which sit on the back of the thyroid. You're supposed to leave them behind. And if you lose your parathyroid hormones, completely throws out your calcium metabolism, and you're on lifetime monitoring and more drugs. And so, and of course, several people died as well. So you had people who are on lifetime therapy, tens of thousands of people every year, for something that was never going to hurt them. And if you looked over the sort of 15, 20 years of this program, from before it until after it, because it's since been stopped, the number of people dying of thyroid cancer each year never changed.
Rochelle, how do you strike the right balance with screening? Because everyone probably knows at least one story about that person who ended up dying of cancer, but it might have been saved if it was picked up earlier. There's without the baby in the bathwater argument here, there's probably value in some screening. How do you get the balance right?
So I think what you're saying is right, and it has to be a balance, and you know, it can save lives. You can pick up those tumours that are not too fast growing, so they are detected by screening, and if you get them early, and you can delay death or prevent death. But it's important that you explain to patients what the potential risks are, and the fact that you can also detect these very slow going cancers that are never going to harm you in your lifetime. And once they're detected, you can't go back. You can't say, well, actually, that may not be. I mean, you can go back. You can just do watchful waiting. But you really need to think about before you start any screening program, what are the benefits? What are the harms? Do you have an effective treatment? Does it really reduce the death rate from the cancer? And as Ian said, a lot of screening programs have increased the number that you detect, and so it looks like the prevalence of the disease, how many people have it, is much higher. But if the mortality doesn't change at all, then that really shows you that you're over-diagnosing and doing more harm than good.
In terms of screening, Ian, this is, in some sense, we've seen the sense in, or come to our senses over prostate screening, haven't we? The prostate-specific antigen blood test, the PSA blood test, for example, you really ought to think and discuss carefully with your doctor about whether or not you should have this test, shouldn't you?
Exactly, yeah. And that's something that, if you look at the numbers, that's gone through a big change. So sometime not so long ago, the rates of diagnosing and treating prostate cancer peaked. Because everyone was getting a PSA, everyone was getting investigated, people were picking up because, again, a lot of us will have prostate cancers. If you look hard enough, you'll find one.
It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to kill you, though.
That's right. And the problem is, again, the surgery for it is it's a large operation with, a high rate of complications of incontinence, things like that. And despite what they say, you know, with the robots and new techniques and I'm a better surgeon, it still has a high rate of complications.
Yeah.
But it is one of the encouraging things to see that the rate declined significantly after peaking. And so, you know, I think that there's been some rationality brought into that.
Mm. Yes, let's talk about over-treatment and what that means. I mean, the Enlightenment thinker Voltaire is supposed to have said that the art of medicine consists of amusing the patient while nature cures the disease, which, despite the fact that it was said some 300 years ago, both of you think probably still has a lot of truth about it. Rochelle, what is over-treatment? In one sense, it just means too many tests, too many opinions, does it?
Well, it means lots of things. So, yes, it can start with too many tests, and as the tests become more sensitive, they can pick up more and more detail, and so you're seeing things that are not, in inverted commas, normal, but what you're really seeing might be normal changes related to someone's age. And so increasingly those things are being picked up, and, you know, one strategy would be to say, well, these are just age-related changes. They don't need to be treated. But what's been happening in reality is that those things end up being treated. So there are things that you can pick up incidentally that might be treated unnecessarily. But in the book, we also talk about things that, like back pain, that get better whatever you do, and don't necessarily need any treatment. And there are a lot of conditions, particularly in our field of musculoskeletal medicine, but even things like stents for people with stable angina, where the evidence is that non-interventions and looking after yourself and lifestyle factors, as you know, might be just as good and obviously have less harms.
This is a very interesting one, the issue of stents, doesn't it? Because stents are little metal tubes that are put in into blocked or very narrowed blood vessels to improve blood flow. And yet, again, you would think, well, this has got to be an obvious good. I mean, how could this be bad? It's got to improve things. But, Rochelle, the evidence doesn't really suggest that, does it? I mean, it's some, not to say that you should never put stents in, but stents are often put in a sense, almost as a preventative without any actual evidence that they actually do any good.
Yeah, so there are, I mean, stents are put in for a variety of reasons, but the common over-treatment is putting in stents in someone who has what we call stable angina. So they're going okay. And in those people, they should really be treated with optimal medical management. And if you think about many of the stents require lifelong treatments to thin the blood, and that again carries significant harm. So again, it's important to balance, you know, will this treatment truly be of benefit in this particular patient, or would something else be safer and just as effective?
Yeah.
And I think we have to think about our treatments. We shouldn't be rushing into doing something every time, but really weighing up the pros and cons.
Mm. Yeah, because the point about stents is that there was a big study, wasn't it, in 2007, the COURAGE study, that showed that people who received treatment but not a stent ended up with a similar chance of dying from heart attacks. So even though it seems obvious that putting in a stent, and this is what seems to drive a lot of medicine, and it's obvious that this must be good, but it's just not backed up by much evidence that it is.
Yeah, that's
well,
right.
Go on, Ian.
Yeah, that's exactly what you said. I mean, we do things because it sounds like a good idea, but we don't think about it deep enough. You know, it's this thinking fast and slow. You know, it's just like, yep, that sounds good. But we need to sit down and rationally think through things. So if you put the stent in, well, can the stent damage the artery? What if the stent clots? How often does it clot up afterwards, and what are the complications of the treatment you need? Lots of things are very interesting. So they did a study in stenting where they randomised people to, because some stenters, the cardiologists, used to remove the clot. So there's a thrombus in there that has clotted the coronary artery, and they would remove that clot before putting the stent in, because they said, well, that's just silly. You can't just leave a clot sitting there. It's blocking the artery. And some would say, well, no, you don't really need to remove it. It's going to be fine. And they did a study where they removed the clot first, and in some patients, they just sort of left it there, and it didn't make any difference. So it just didn't make any difference whether you actually took the obstruction out, which doesn't make any sense at all. But that's what the science tells us.
Actually told us,
and
yeah.
That's what we need to listen to, not what sounds good, because it's too easy to make things sound good.
Yeah, we just don't know as much as we think we know, don't we? That's part of the problem. Helen from Coogee says, can you ask about statins? Statins is a massive topic, I know. I read a long time ago that Big Pharma changed the parameters to catch more people, therefore increasing sales. I'm very wary whenever my GP suggests going on these. Ian or Rochelle? I warn you, putting your foot in this, your toe in this pond.
Well, we can put our toe in and again talk about, you know, making sure that the people that you treat are better off as a result. And it's, you know, if half or three quarters of the population need to be treated for high cholesterol, maybe we have a problem with the levels. And we have to be really sure that, sure, it might reduce your cholesterol level, but does it really change your lifespan? Does it really reduce mortality? And a lot of the things that we talk about in screening and in also treatment of hypertension and cholesterol is it might do what it's supposed to do. It might reduce blood pressure or reduce cholesterol. But the important question is, does it stop people dying? Does it, you know, reduce the number of heart attacks and strokes? Those things are the important endpoints.
Yeah. No, and look, I know there's some personal experience. I had this exact conversation with my cardiologist who insisted we look at the numbers. So I, you know, went on a course of statins. We did look at the numbers. They did seem to improve. So therefore, that, I suppose, was that as far as I was concerned. But you're right, Rochelle, whether or not in the end it makes a difference is in many cases just not proven, is it?
Well, sometimes it does, and I think there's a case for statins, but it's also, well, what other ways could you achieve that? So if somebody is overweight and has high cholesterol, you know, is it possible that instead of taking medication, they could control their cholesterol levels with diet? And that would have other effects. It wouldn't just be treating a blood test. You would also be treating their risk of getting diabetes and a whole lot of other health problems at the same time. And I have a similar problem with I see a lot of people with knee pain from arthritis and worn out knees, and they're in their 50s and 60s. And sometimes if the patient's overweight, we know that if they lose weight, it will significantly improve their knee pain.
Yes.
And sometimes even people can avoid having a knee replacement for a very long time if they lose weight. And they're going, oh, well, can't you just replace the knee? Like, it's just easier, you know, I don't want to lose weight. And I have to explain to them, well, it's not just for your knees, because if you lose weight, you won't need a knee replacement. You won't be subject to the complications of a knee replacement, which can be, you know, quite devastating. And you're less likely to get diabetes and get arterial disease, peripheral neuropathy, kidney failure, blindness, heart disease, and all the other things that go with it. And wouldn't that be good? You know, but often we just don't go through this process of explaining things to people, and we're kind of like, it's just easier to put you on
the list. Is part of the problem here, Rochelle, because doctors... Oh, well, doctors are only human. I know they're scientists too, but humans like to be seen to be helpful. And therefore, doing something as opposed to doing nothing is likely to be a better course of action for doctors who worry that if you say to a patient, look, this is a problem associated with your age and stage of life, and, you know, that's what it is. As opposed to the doctor saying, aha, yes, well, if you put you on these pills or we do this operation, things will improve, even though the evidence doesn't support that. In other words, surgeons don't get sued for doing operations. They get sued for maybe not doing operations. Is some of that working, do you think, Rochelle?
Well, I think most doctors try and balance and do the right thing. And I think that it's important to have conversations with patients, and doing nothing active doesn't mean not caring for the patient or not managing the patient. And doing something could be as simple as providing good advice, reassurance, being there for review. Those sorts of things are really important. And if you explain things to patients and explain that my treatment won't change your outcome, and I'm you know, protecting you against the potential for harm, and I'm saving you money from trying treatments that have been proven not to work, I think patients will appreciate that. And I think lots of doctors are empathic and understand these things. And I guess what we take exception to in the book is that a lot of doctors are not scientists as well, and that's the problem, that doctors need to be better educated in evidence and use that evidence to inform their decisions and share that information with patients so that they can make evidence-informed decisions about what's best.
So even though they were trained as scientists, they're not practicing it. Okay. Well, look,
trained. We're not trained as doctors in the scientific principles and critical appraisal, and particularly in surgery, it's more of an apprenticeship where we just learn from seeing and doing, and we don't learn the science behind what we do.
Which leads us to the question, gee, look how time has flown, of what we do about this and what's the solution. You say in large part it's about having much better conversations and that there are five questions the patient should always ask. Rochelle, what are they?
Yeah, so they are, what's the evidence for this treatment that you're offering me? What are the potential benefits and what are the potential risks or harms? What would happen if I do nothing? And what are the alternatives? That's really the questions. And it's really about giving space for patients to ask those questions. And we were on a forum this morning and one of the doctors suggested we should have those five questions up in our offices and spread them around to remind doctors to get patients to ask those questions or give them the space to ask them. And also as a reminder to patients or to tell the patient that this is a good surgery where we're open to answering your questions about these sorts of things.
Mm. Do I really need this test, treatment or procedure? Two, what are the risks and what are the possible harms? Three, are there simpler or safer options? Four, what happens if I do nothing? And five, what does it cost? When you say, Ian, that doctors aren't practicing science a lot of the time, I mean, a commonplace assumption is that a lot of doctors are overly influenced by big pharma. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, and I think that doctors are influenced by other things as well. Partly the opioid crisis is the companies heavily marketing and falsely claiming, you know, what the drugs did. And, you know, it's difficult, I think, for doctors to look up everything. But it is, in the end, their responsibility. I mean, they're the ones that write the prescriptions. So they're the ones that have to take the responsibility for knowing and have a little bit of skepticism when a drug company promotes its own drug. I mean, you've got to really think about that a little bit.
Rochelle, if there was one procedure or treatment that you'd like to see never performed again, which one would it be?
I don't know that I can choose one. I can choose a few. This week we published a paper just showing that platelet-rich plasma injections do not work. They're no better than placebo for soft tissue injuries.
What about stem cell injections?
Stem cells are unproven, and most of the evidence for stem cell injections for things like osteoarthritis show that they're probably not effective in their current form. And I think, you know, it's exciting and maybe in the future, but not currently. Mm. People are, you know, eating into their super, moving into state, selling their children to have this treatment, and often highly inappropriately and in the absence of evidence.
Mm.
Ian, so that's another one.
Yeah. Ian, for you, what about spinal injections?
Yeah, I think injections across the board, I see it all the time. So platelet-rich plasma is a big one that Rochelle said, but steroid injections in the spine is another huge one. I mean, it's increasing massively and you know, the evidence for them compared to placebo is very questionable, and yet they're just commonly done because they're seen as, oh, well, you know, I'll send the patient away, that'll give them something to do and probably make them feel a bit better, and by the time I see them, they may be a little bit better. And it's costing a lot of money because now it's all done, you know, under CT control, and so the procedure, it's not that the drug's cheap, but the procedure itself is costing us, you know, as a society, a lot of money. That would be one.
You'd also add in, well, we've discussed arthroscopies of the knee, you'd probably throw in arthroscopies of the shoulder too, wouldn't you?
I would for some conditions, and probably throw in spinal fusion for back pain.
And hip arthroscopies for hip pain.
All right. Look, it's a fascinating book, and it's written in a very accessible fashion. So I'd highly recommend it if you were interested in pursuing it further. It's called Hypocrisy: How Doctors Are Betraying Their Oath. Rachel Bookbinder and Ian Harris have been our guests tonight. Professor Bookbinder is a rheumatologist and epidemiologist at Monash, and Director of the Monash Department of Clinical Epidemiology, and Professor Ian Harris, an orthopaedic surgeon at Liverpool, St George and Sutherland Hospitals, and Professor of Orthopaedic Surgery at the University of New South Wales. I only indulge in these long descriptions to say that they clearly know their stuff and have clearly earned their place to say these things as well. So listen carefully. But those five things: do I really need it? What are the risks? Are there simpler or safer options? What happens if I do nothing? And what are the costs? To both of you, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.